I'm Jason Van Medding.
And I'm Ksenia Chmutina.
Welcome to Disasters Deconstructed podcast.
I think vulnerability is probably the most difficult concept, you know, one of the most difficult concepts that we endure or engage with in disaster studies. And, you know, there are so many arguments around it, right? We keep talking and keep defining and keep trying to understand what it is we mean by vulnerability. But yeah, it'll be exciting to talk to Joanne today, and hopefully she'll shed some light onto it.
Part of what we're trying to do is to break down some of these difficult to understand concepts into a discourse that people can really engage with. Today, to talk about vulnerability, we're joined by Dr. Joanne Jordan. She is an environmental social scientist, and she works on the interconnected problems of climate change, poverty, and risk. She uses participatory methods and works alongside communities to investigate risk at a local level, and she uses a lot of really innovative communication methods, which is what really strikes me about her work.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to talking to Joanne today. I've been following her on Twitter as well. And it's just quite interesting to see how different people unpack vulnerability. You know, like, personally, when I saw the term, the concept, you know, for the first time in English, I thought, oh, what a brilliant way of discussing or what it entails, right? Because English is just so simple and so precise. But then the more you start thinking about the word, the more you kind of realize that it creates more problems than precisions. Mm. Because it's so precise. And I wonder whether Joanne will be able to unpack some of this today through the work that she's done with different communities.
Let's give her a call and see. Joanne, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, John.
Hi.
So cool to talk to you. I don't think many people know that we did our PhDs at the same time in Queens, in Belfast.
I know, many years ago.
Right, it has been a while. But we were like in the same lab for a while, right?
Exactly, yeah, a couple of years.
Yeah. And it's been really, really cool to follow your work on Twitter, and we've kind of gone in different directions in terms of where we work, but we've ended up researching a lot of the same things, which I think is pretty cool. And so, like, some of the things that really strike me about the stuff that you've been doing, particularly with your research in Bangladesh, is like the level of nuance which you're able to approach communicating to different audience through different mediums, and like using stories and different methods of communication which are not necessarily academic writing to convey your findings.
Yeah,
So tell us a bit about ways that you communicate research.
So I've been using performance theater and a little bit of photography, and then more recently film, and then combining that with public events to build awareness on climate change, to go back into communities and communicate what I found and give them an opportunity, you know, to tell me what, you know, did I get anything right? And also, you know, what did I get wrong? So that, you know, the communication didn't end after the results. Trying to create something which is accessible to more people, which is hopefully entertaining and people feel safe, you know, to join the conversation.
Today we want to talk to you about vulnerability. We're doing a kind of short series we're calling The Ingredients of a Disaster. So we're we talked about natural hazard last week, and next week what do we have lined up next week? Exposure next week. But today we want to talk about vulnerability, which is obviously a key component of your work. And so reading a recent article you wrote in Climate and Development, you argued for the importance of a more radical, transformational, gendered, and parasensitive frame for moving beyond coping mechanisms to strategies that deal with fundamental root causes of vulnerability. So there's lots to unpack there, and we can't get into all of it, right?
Did I say that? I can't remember. Only
you said that. It's a really good sentence. But obviously, we talk a lot about root causes in disaster studies. And so in terms of vulnerability, how would you explain vulnerability to a lay audience?
I think I don't want to use the term, but, you know, it's the lack of capacity that a person has to cope with or adapt to shocks. But even the way that I've defined that sounds quite negative because I focused on the lack of something. Mm. Which I guess we'll get into a little bit later.
Yeah.
That's very simplistic. But I think that that's one of the easiest ways to understand it is about how people respond to a particular shock.
One of the things in the last year or two that I found really interesting was reading about vulnerability from the point of view of as being a positive thing in relationships, where like Brené Brown and kind of that perspective of, especially for men, being vulnerable is a good thing in many ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was really interesting for me to rethink vulnerability as not a weakness. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing I was thinking was vulnerability is often kind of foisted on people as well by other actors. And it's not a choice. So it can be used in many ways. Right. So if we're framing vulnerability in the kind of way that we do in disaster studies, you talked about root causes of vulnerability. So in your work, what would they be?
I think, you know, some of those that come up again and again, it's about where you live, right? So people that are vulnerable tend to be more likely to live in areas that are exposed to climate shocks. And their livelihoods are often more sensitive to climate shocks or extreme weather events. So, you know, for example, in my work, really interesting example, you know, when I think back to 2007 cyclone in Bangladesh, was that fishermen stayed at sea, you know, despite haven't actually received the cyclone warnings, and it was claimed that most employers forced employees to stay at sea by warning them that if they left, you know, they'd be made redundant and they wouldn't be paid their salary. So in this sense, their capacity to protect themselves from this cyclone wasn't just, you know, this kind of, you know, wasn't actually the shock, but it was constrained by the poor and fragile livelihoods. You know, they're based in these climate-sensitive economic activities. And in this case, it brings up another really important issue, you know, is patron-client relationships based on exploitation, which essentially led them to, you know, risk their lives to sustain future income generation. So they were trying to balance, you know, dealing with the particular risk of a climate hazard, you know, versus, you know, will they have a job in the future? You know, if they survive, will they have a salary and so on? So I think that's something that comes up in many different ways in terms of their actually livelihood, how resilient that is. And then probably more recently, more around probably the lack of access to diverse portfolio of assets. So, you know, as you know, those with fewer assets tend to have fewer choices and weaker strategies for dealing with different types of shocks. So in the context of climate change, then it's not just obviously the portfolio in terms of the diversity, but what are those assets, or, you know, what are their climate resilient? So I was thinking about this earlier today, and, you know, finishing up a paper that, you know, touches on this, and there was one transcript I've been rereading a bit on this based on my work in Shandeep, and I felt that this really kind of brought this out better than I can explain. So I'd really like to just share this very short extract, which I think it kind of brings this together rather than me saying lack of access to diverse portfolio of assets, which sounds really dry, you know. And so this is an interview in Shandeep in Southeast Bangladesh, and the woman has shared with me, you know, we do not have enough money. So when our house eroded, we move a little, then again our house eroded, and then again we moved. We bought the land and made this new house 2 years ago, My husband took a loan. We're still paying it back. This house will go in the water after 1 or 2 years, and then we'll need money again to make a new house. We do not have enough money for a safer place. How will we survive? With little earnings, how can we eat properly or send our children to school? And, you know, I think this example really highlights the difficult choices people have to make in the context of very limited resources. So it's, I think it highlights, you know, not just the need for assets, but assets which are resilient and allows them to reduce their vulnerability, in this case, to future climate-related shocks. Somebody's livelihood could be more resilient to climate shocks, but then their vulnerability is then influenced by other people in the community whose livelihoods are not as resilient. So, for example, someone who owns, a shop within a community, to me would seem, you know, quite resilient. It's not overly climate sensitive. But then obviously during a cyclone, someone's not going to be able to afford to buy food and that shopper is going to be less able to do so. Or they might be able to buy food at that time, but would need, you know, to pay it later. So the idea that, you know, different groups of people's vulnerability impacts other people's vulnerability.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I've been reading about structural violence and vulnerability recently, and it's kind of the whole definition, I guess, of violence when it comes to vulnerability is that, you know, this is the harm. So the system that creates root causes is actually the harm that can be avoided, and therefore vulnerable people, or, you know, the creation of vulnerable station can be considered as violence. And I think it's a really interesting perspective when we talk about root causes.
So in your work in Bangladesh in particular, are there any kind of social divisions and groups within society that you would see as having different levels of vulnerability?
Yeah, I mean, in my work, it's, you know, more recently focused on gender and taking an intersectional perspective around that. So, you know, it's clearly important to understand, you know, the gender differences in vulnerability, you know, in my research to climate change, but particularly, you know, how women and men been impacted, you know, in different ways, and not just focusing on women's vulnerability and looking at how sociocultural norms and practices, how they influence different factors, right? So how they influence, you know, access and distribution of resources, how people participate in decision-making, division of labor, and also power structures and persistent inequality, how people experience climate-related risk in the everyday and how that varies between different groups. So clearly different groups of women experience climate-related shocks differently, you know, due to their position and power relations based on these kind of intersecting social categorizations. So, for example, how does gender intersect with age, marital status, class and race and so on? So really trying to move away from, you know, just looking at gender in terms of, you know, women or men, and looking at, you know, how different groups of people are impacted in different ways. And I think probably within, you know, kind of gender literature within climate change, it tends to focus a lot more on, you know, women, and doesn't necessarily, you know, dissect that and looking at how that intersects with these different categorizations. And I think that's, you know, a key area where future research needs to address.
Yeah, for sure. I think there is a little bit more towards intersectionality now, which is great to see. But not enough. And, you know, you've said in the very beginning that you're interested in both vulnerability of men and women. But there's been quite a lot of backlash to some suggestion to look at male vulnerabilities, thinking, well, you know, there is kind of enough tension to men. Let's talk about women and girls, particularly from feminist academics. What do you think of that?
I mean, I probably should say, as much as, you know, I've highlighted the need to focus on men and women, my research has focused more on different groups of women, and I would like to kind of move in more to looking at different groups of men and women. I mean, I understand some of the criticism, but my view is, if you want to address gender equality, you can't just focus on women. It's about the relationships between men and women, right? So for me, I can't quite understand completely that criticism. And also, there's, you know, yes, there are numerous examples in Bangladesh. You know, in the 1991 cyclone, five times the number of women died compared to men. But equally, I don't know if you've been, you know, kind of reading up on some of the research on Indian drought. You know, there's been very kind of high numbers of farmers that tend to be male that have committed suicide due to the drought. And, you know, there's numerous examples like this. I think there's some issues around it. I think what I find quite probably maybe more worrying at the moment is there's this focus on women as agents of change, which obviously is, you know, it's a positive movement. But at the same time, for me, my concern is that a way to push, you know, the burden of responsibility and extra work onto women, you know, to deal with climate change, you know, pushing that from the state onto the most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it highlights their capacities. But you could argue that actually it's operating in a similar way as seeing women as victims. You know, it's highlighting their resilience, but in a way that it's their responsibility. There was one really interesting example where women were highlighting that, you know, high levels of salinity, so in Bangladesh that's roughly about 6 months of the year, how that was impacting women's skin, so how they felt this would increase the risk of skin diseases and also the roughness of their skin. So originally when I heard this, I felt, you know, that's to do with the appearance of your skin, and I hadn't quite understood what's the implication of this. And this is more likely to happen women than men, because, you know, more likely to be cleaning dishes and washing children and so on. But some of the women I was talking to actually linked this to marriage prospects and the amount of dowry to be paid when their daughter would marry. So some of them had heard cases where, you know, their neighbours had to pay more dowry because the roughness of the skin was linked to, you know, the level of attractiveness of a girl or a woman. So I thought that was really interesting how high levels of salinity can have all of these really unexpected impacts. So in that case, that would be about how gender intersects with, you know, skin texture, skin appearance. But then it intersects with class, because clearly wealthier households, you know, within the community are more likely to have access to water reservoirs, so they can avoid or at least reduce their use of saline water. And in that way, that would place them at, you know, a significant advantage compared to poor women who do not have access to reservoirs. So it's kind of one example that kind of teases out how gender intersects in different ways, but then it links to men as well, because it's linked to marriage prospects, and also it's about how, in this case, you can argue how water is prioritized within the household, and, you know, what are the gender implications of that.
I was thinking when you were talking about you know, the way that men are impacted by vulnerability as well. And often, you know, men who are pushed into this state where they feel disempowered and are perhaps perceive themselves as weak, which is, in a patriarchal society, that's not an acceptable feeling to have for a man, right? So it's all about context, and obviously that's different in every location, in every community. And your work definitely connects at the local level to the context. And you mentioned also a bit earlier about the relationship to capacity, that the idea of resilience or tapping into capacity can almost be weaponized against the most marginalized as well. So, like, why, for you, why does local matter? And that sort of understanding of context and sociocultural norms, why does it matter in your research and in communicating the stories about these places?
I mean, I think if you look at any given intervention, you know, whether that's at the national level or the international level, whether that's going to work, you know, whether it's going to be accepted or modified or completely rejected by those at the local level will depend on whether it fits with their understandings of climate change and their everyday realities. What are their priorities? What are their needs? So if we actually really want to create effective climate resilience strategies, you know, it's crucial that we understand how does the community work, that we examine gender histories, as well as cultural and power dynamics. And that clearly applies to all interventions at the local level, not just those, you know, trying to address climate change. So for me, that's key that we try to engage local voices and in my work to try to do that in more creative ways so that we don't leave the disadvantaged behind and that we don't predefine their problems or bypass, you know, their realities, which, you know, we often see in some work. So I think it's really given emphasis to those at the local level and then kind of connected to my work on communication through the arts. It's about, you know, it's about how do you tell their story, but you tell their story with them as well. And, you know, that their voices are given center stage within that. If we don't focus on the local level and what people are doing at the local level, we end up really not considering the majority of interventions that there actually are in existence to deal with climate change.
And I guess if we don't appreciate kind of the local context, you know, that brings us back to this discussion of vulnerability and the way we impose the vulnerability on people who may not really be vulnerable because we, you know, we don't understand really what it means in a local context. And so Jason and I, we kind of did this little exercise on Twitter and asked people to tell us how vulnerability translates into different languages. And we had like, what, 53 maybe or 54 languages translations, which is pretty cool. But across the board, the meaning, literal meaning of vulnerability was about being needy or, you know, about weakness or kind of wounded related things. Or, you know, the good translations were, you know, to be without access, to be without anything or being unprotected. So all the translations had quite negative connotation. So how are there any alternatives? You know, how can we talk about vulnerability without actually diminishing the roles of the people who we perceive as vulnerable?
That's a really tough question. and I think, you know, it reminds me of all our terms, you know, some of which that I use, you know, if you think about, you know, calling someone poor or, you know, the term slum and so on. They're similar in the sense of they all have these kind of negative connotations. And like you said, it's focusing on the lack of something rather than emphasizing people's capacities. The only issue I have with this is then some people argue that's why we should, you know, move towards resilience rather than vulnerability, because people argue that resilience, you know, is more positive. It focuses on people's capacities. And then the critique around resilience is that it kind of, in the context of my research, is that kind of conventional resilience theory depoliticizes climate change. So that's where, you know, I think it's like the traditional needs assessment approach with its focus on vulnerability. That was kind of part of the reason why people shifted more towards sustainable livelihoods approach, because it was focusing like resilience on the positive. First of all, who are those people? Who are, you know, who's setting the agenda? What are their particular values and objectives? How are they defining that resilience and why? And, you know, is it grounded in experiences of those living, you know, on the front lines? It's about being careful about how we use vulnerability, that we're not reducing very complex social categorizations into these very neat boxes which don't represent reality. So, you know, moving away from identifying, you know, women as vulnerable or particular groups of people, because clearly within those categories people can be very different, women of different ages and so on, and marital status, and how that would influence their vulnerability. You know, how do we communicate this? You know, when we actually carry out our research, asking these questions to those we actually research in accessible ways and trying to understand, you know, what's their perception of this term, and would there be different terms within their local dialect that they would prefer to be used? So having that conversation to start off with. And I think it's also just within different languages, different words can have very subtle meanings, you know, without completely understanding, you know, what's attached to it at the local level. And then also I think it's about, you know, how do we create that knowledge collaboratively? So when we're talking about vulnerability, that we're not just writing about communities, but we've had this kind of two-way communication. And are there different types of innovative ways that we can communicate with communities to emphasize, you know, their stories and their priorities? And, you know, that kind of conversation where they can tell us when we've got something wrong. I probably can't think of a particular term that we could use that would be maybe more inclusive or less negative, but I think it's about being careful about the way that we apply it and that we avoid trying to label particular groups as vulnerable and start to kind of dissect those different groups.
Somewhere I started to write down ideas about how to kind of reclaim vulnerability as a concept that was not about weakness. And so that we don't, so in some way we wouldn't always need to use it with a negative connotation. So you were talking about, you know, the way that a lot of people like to argue for a more positive approach to kind of mobilizing people and instead of pointing out what's wrong, trying to use the language of resilience or capacities to and kind of strength-based approaches to say, like, these are the things we can build on. And it also connects to literature that's looking at how to change people's minds with messaging. There's interesting literature there, which is talking about how people don't really mobilize based on things that make them feel bad. And they mobilize around things that excite them and they can see themselves contributing to making a difference. So, like, how do we overcome that? Of course, we know the ways in which resilience has been used to further marginalize people, you know, with by powerful actors with a kind of neoliberal agenda. At the same time, I kind of feel like there's a lot of literature on resilience and even resilience as a concept can be really useful and can be reclaimed. And I know that's maybe a controversial thing to say. Is there like a balance to be found? How do we tap into the fact that people need that kind of positive story to believe in, to contribute to, and at the same time be true to the problems that we face, you know?
I admit this is something I've really struggled with, and where my work has been critiqued around this kind of climate change communication through the arts, because my work, you know, it's communicating how people experience climate risk and the different strategies they might adapt, but ultimately the stories are quite negative. And it does fall into this trap that, you know, you're not telling a positive story, you're not explaining, you know, what the solution is. And I completely take that criticism and probably don't have the answer. But I suppose for me, where I feel a bit probably uncomfortable is, you know, we're researchers. That's, you know, that's our job. So for me, when I'm involved in communication, I want to communicate, you know, those stories that have been shared with me. So I think it's really tricky to be true to the research. I know it's grounded in science. And then also, how do you adapt that in a way that's actually true to the findings? So I think that's really difficult. I think one way I attempted to do this is around this idea of, you know, what are the solutions? What can people do? My view is, I mean, in this context, my work is, it's not my job to tell people, you know, what the solutions are. In this work on the performance theatre, it's about me presenting the problems to people, very diverse groups of people. And in one of the performances, this came up. So one of the performances was at a CBA conference in Dhaka. It was so interesting. So there was almost 200 people there, you know, people working for DFID, World Bank, so on, then very local based charities. And at the end of the podcast, there's this interactive session. So it's essentially, you know, we end before the story ends and they have to come up with the solution and suggest, you know, what do they think people should do? So it's interesting because in a way they become the theatre, and sometimes slightly reluctantly, this group of people who work in this area, for those that don't work in climate change, but work in development, and we couldn't come up with a workable solution. So there'd be some really good examples, and it wasn't that it wouldn't work, but it would work for, you know, one group of people that might have an impact somewhere else. You can actually put the onus on, you know, the group of people watching it. And they have to think creatively, especially in that context when people were working, you know, on this issue. You know, it was a very emotional reaction that people had, where some people were really disappointed in themselves that they couldn't, you know, think of a workable solution, and they were presented, you know, these issues. For me, I suppose I find it very hard to tell a positive story around my work because a lot of it is very, a lot of it is very negative. Something I wrote down when you actually asked that question, and I just wrote down Hurricane Katrina, because I'm sure you've seen the, you know, that photograph of the posters saying, what is it? We are not resilient. And I thought that was really interesting because we were talking about, you know, labeling people as vulnerable and how that's negative. And we're then talking about, well, what terms can we come up that focus on the positive? And this was an example of community members actually resisting the fact that they were being called resilient. Because then it's expecting people, you know, to, you know, I can't remember where I read this, but it's expecting people to pull themselves up by their collective bootstraps and all this focus on, you know, Cameron's big society and essentially pushing risk from the state onto the local level. But that was really interesting how, you know, we can talk about positive terms, but how people can resist it in some way. I think the problem with resilience, you know, broadly speaking, is that the way it's currently used, it's kind of very narrow conceptualizations of resilience and very traditional. So it's focusing very much on, you know, which you would cover in your work in disaster risk management in terms of, you know, people bouncing back, you know, from a particular disaster rather than actually reducing their vulnerability. It's very narrow as opposed to kind of the work that, you know, some of the work that I read that really focuses on how resilience can actually be something which is focused on a radical agenda, which, you know, tries to address root causes of vulnerability. So there's this kind of tension between resilience and vulnerability. But then that type of work is probably more of a, you know, it's like a resilience vulnerability approach. So it lets you look at both. So it lets you look at how resilience leads to very diverse outcomes on vulnerability, as opposed to saying, you know, high resilience equals low vulnerability, but actually lets you look at the complexity of that relationship.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's just our academic willing to just silo everything and define everything, isn't it? And if the definition isn't clear, we just spend hours and hours just arguing about it.
Resilience has existed for many, you know, years. These debates have been going on in mathematics, ecology, long before, you know, we stole the concept into disaster risk management. Obviously, these concepts are really important, but in many cases, we're using a sort of slightly different concept to say the same, same thing.
Well, Joanne, thanks so much for spending time with us. It's been so cool.
And I, what other way would I like to spend a Sunday?
Oh, sorry.
It's Joanne Jordan. Thank you for listening to the Disasters Deconstructed podcast.